hello and welcome to another Security Channel podcast. I'm Curtis Franklin, your host for these podcasts, and we've got an interesting topic today. I'm going to be talking with Josh Damont, who's Director of Research for a company called SecureWorks. And we're talking about the security breaches possible with media software and media players. Now, if you're listening to this, the odds are pretty good that you understand what the possibilities are for a media player, but it's also quite possible that you haven't really taken a lot of time to think about the security implications of these things. I know that's not the first thing that I think about when I see Steve Jobs introducing a new iPod, but the fact is that the media players are becoming so capable and so large that even if they're not subject to particular attacks, they are great infectious vectors. In other words, they can carry the infections from one point to another. And if you have a piece of software like the RealPlayer or like Microsoft Media Player, each of which has been shown at various times to have vulnerabilities, then the possibility of getting an infection on a home machine, loading it into a media player, and carrying it inside an office firewall becomes tremendous. So Josh and I spent some time talking about these vulnerabilities. Now, I've got to apologize for something right at the beginning of this podcast. We've got some microphone placement problems during the first question. But if you can hang on for the first 20 seconds or so of the podcast, we managed to get things sorted out and move on from there. I've got a ton of podcasts lined up over the next 3 or 4 weeks. I'm going to have at least a couple a week. This is part of CMP's overall push to have a great podcast presence. I'll be talking more about that after the interview with Josh, but right now let's get on with that, talking about the security implications of media players, Josh Damont. Well, I will admit, a little bit surprised when I heard about a vulnerability in RealPlayer. Can you tell me a little bit more about what this is?
Sure. This is a condition in the RealPlayer software which would allow an attacker to create a music file which would be encoded in such a way as to cause a malfunction, which would allow them to run arbitrary software on the machine that RealPlayer was running on when they attempted to play that music.
Okay. Is this something that is actually out there in the wild, or is this something that's just been shown through a proof of concept so far?
Well, a little bit of both. We haven't seen it really, really widespread. However, this was an example of something that was discovered and published by what's called a gray hat security researcher, where it's ambiguous as to whether or not this person is actually on the side of consumers and on the side of society, where they would actually report the vulnerability to the company, to the vendor, and allow them to create a patch or fix before going public. It's not entirely clear that this person actively used their proof of concept software for malicious purposes, but clearly they did not go through the correct channels to protect consumers, to protect the public at large when they discover this information. We're confident that there are exploits of this vulnerability out in the wild. What's happened is that they haven't been quite as successful as previous attempts at using that exploit to spread to the maximum number of victims.
Okay. Well, in terms of severity, where would you place this vulnerability?
This is a whole class of vulnerabilities that will give an attacker complete control over the target machine, but requires initially that the user accept some content from a remote source.
Okay, so there has to be some sort of positive action on the part of the individual user before this can begin to take over their machine.
Yes, there has to be some kind of positive acknowledgement or reception of the content. That could be in the form of them going out to a file sharing network such as LimeWire and actively seeking out the file that might be posted and might be a new song by a popular band or might purport to be a new song by a popular band. Or it could be a spoofed email message that appears in their inbox from a known or unknown source, which purports to have a funny TV or video clip that they could play through their Real Player by clicking on it in the email. So not necessarily an initiated action by the victim, but at the minimum a positive acknowledgement of some incoming content. So I would put this below so-called remote passive vulnerabilities in Windows, whereby an attacker could just reach out to a remote machine without any action by the target user or target system and completely take control without anyone being there. However, at the same time, an experienced or seasoned attacker, if he uses the right kind of packaging and the right kind of candy coating is what we typically call it in the industry, he or she could spread this vulnerability quite far using things like point-to-point networking as well as mass emailing or mass mailing technologies.
Well, now, could this be done as a piece of a file or as a modification of a file that otherwise plays and seems like a perfectly valid real media file?
You could theoretically play it for some time, but there would probably be some kind of error. There would be some kind of error that would present itself. Typically, unless the attacker was highly sophisticated, it would appear as if the real media, not just appear, but what would happen is the real media application would shut down and freeze up.
Okay.
By then, the damage is already done.
Sure, sure. Now, I take it that thus far, this particular vulnerability is limited to the real player. But based on your experience with vulnerabilities and malware for some time, is this the type of exploit that is necessarily limited to that one media player?
No. Other types of media players, Windows Media Player from Microsoft in particular, has also suffered these exact same kind of vulnerabilities. The technical specifics of this issue, it is a heap buffer overflow, and we find heap buffer overflow type vulnerabilities in virtually every class of software, up to and including the Java Virtual Machine, which is something people have typically thought of as being impervious to buffer overflow type vulnerabilities.
Okay.
So this particular type not only has affected from time to time different types of media playing technologies, but almost any form of software.
Now, we're going to talk about some more specifics shortly, but let me jump ahead just a moment. I know that when I was talking with Microsoft earlier this year about some of the new security features of what was at the time Longhorn, now Vista, they specifically targeted buffer overflow as something they want to design against. Do you see signs that software companies are beginning to make the operating systems and applications more resistant to buffer overflow attacks generically? Or is this something that we're going to be stuck with for a long time to come?
Paradoxically, the answer to both those questions is yes. Yes, Microsoft in particular, and other software companies to a lesser extent, are working furiously on stemming the tide of these buffer overflow vulnerabilities, not just on a case-by-case basis, but also efforts, as you've indicated, as Microsoft has indicated through Longhorn, now called Vista, to minimize the possibility for them in total. At the same time, these vulnerabilities are going to continue to be around for a considerable length of time, at least the next few years, and into a smaller and smaller extent, I'm convinced that they'll be around and they will affect consumers for 10 or more years at the minimum, based on what I've seen of how legacy technology continues to be used and continues to be maintained in our society. What's happened is that Microsoft, first, let me mention that Microsoft's noble efforts with Longhorn should be applauded. Unfortunately, they may have bitten off a little more than they can chew. And as you may or may not know, Vista is in the process of being completely reset, which is to say that there's talk within Microsoft of taking everything that's been done and essentially starting over from scratch. So it's, I wouldn't, if I was a consumer or a corporate customer, I would not necessarily count on getting that within any type of specific time frame. But without a doubt, Microsoft has the resources and the willpower and will ship that technology eventually. What they have done in Windows XP Service Pack 2 and also in a new version of their Microsoft compiler is shored up the way that they do keep freeing of memory allocations made while the program is running to make it more difficult for these type of, it doesn't remove the vulnerability per se, but it makes it so that the vulnerability can't be exploited to take control of the machine. It takes what would normally allow an attacker total control and instead makes it so that the worst the attacker could possibly do is crash the application.
Okay.
The key to understand there is that that is in the way that new programs are written when compiled with a specific configuration with the Microsoft compiler. The vast majority of companies take 1 to 3 years to license those new compilers and use those new compilers in new software product developments.
Right.
Additionally, the vast majority of them, especially smaller development shops, are unaware of that option, and it's not turned on by default. Furthermore, that option tends to have a negative performance impact on software. So things like video games, some statistics packages, anything where speed or performance is important, the product managers and those vendors are going to be very reluctant to turn that security switch on.
Fascinating.
Additionally, patches and updates to existing software can't be compiled with the new option. It requires a totally new installation.
Oh, that's lovely.
Unfortunately, change happens slowly sometimes, and big systemic changes in software can take, as we've seen in the past, years or even decades. Without a doubt, I can tell you, knowing some of the security people at Microsoft, their intentions are entirely genuine and their efforts are very sincere.
Okay.
What I've said notwithstanding.
But let me ask a question about non-workstation products. Because we know that, especially on sound files, we have a variety of different portable players. The same is true of video files, and it looks like, there's some indications that we're about to get some major new pushes towards portable video players in the next couple of weeks. I'm not so concerned about these players being affected from a performance standpoint, since they tend to run on different operating systems and with different applications. But how likely is it that these could be infection vectors for spreading these things?
In the short term, it takes 6 to 18 months for security researchers to typically get into a new piece of software. And that's malicious researchers or legitimate researchers, and there's unfortunately some fairly talented people on both sides of that equation, really into a complex piece of software where they're really going to find serious vulnerabilities. So in the short term, I would not look for any serious problems right when the software is released. Experience tells me that in the long term, these new software applications, particularly due to the complexity and particularly due to the fact that there's a lot of new software development, these 1.0 products tend to put a lot of pressure on the developers from a scheduling standpoint, and we know as an absolute fact that scheduling pressure is the single biggest leading indicator of shipping insecure software. That in the 12 to 24 months, you'll see from one source or another one or more vulnerabilities in these types of applications.
Okay. So let's ask the obvious question on two different levels. For the individual user, what do they do aside from shutting down listening to all media files? And as someone who is heavily into podcasting, that seems to me to be an awfully bad solution.
I would recommend to consumers that they do two things. First, license and use desktop antivirus software. Antivirus software on the desktop is going to be really three things. It's going to be the one solution that's going to tend to find these types of malicious files as they get onto the desktop. And because it's a file scanning technology, it's relatively well placed to detect and prevent these types of attacks. Those aren't perfect solutions, but for most consumers, that will give them the amount of risk reduction that they're really looking for. Secondly, and possibly more importantly, I would recommend users be very careful about where they get their software, particularly the allure of these point-to-point file sharing networks, that especially and particularly the ones that are reputed for pirated or otherwise free content. You're taking a significant risk, not really legal risk, although that's there, but more so security risk. When you take all this content that really you don't know where it came from, anyone could have put it there, that's typically the first place malicious hackers are going to try to spread a file of this type. Thirdly, is piggyback on your corporate security infrastructure. So if you have a laptop and you you bring it into and outside the office, your corporation is typically going to have some fairly extensive perimeter security. And while still sticking within your employment policy or your employee handbook, you know, if you're going to download some of this content, why not pull it down after hours while you're still at the office? Have it run through the corporate security software. Once it's on your laptop, you know it's relatively safe. Play it once you get home. Keep it on your hard disk, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. And that actually segues pretty neatly into my next question, which is if you are a security director for an enterprise and you're aware of all this going on within your user base, what should you be doing to protect your enterprise assets from these sorts of attacks?
Right now, the two best solutions that the corporate security director has to mitigate this problem is a perimeter-based intrusion prevention solution, purely by example, the iSensor, which is sold and offered by SecureWorks. It may or may not make sense to have that managed by a third party. It generally, in all cases, except for the largest companies, makes sense to have some type of management partner in place. Secondly, an email server-based security solution, purely by example, such as the SteelClad service that's offered by SecureWorks. There are a number of other good services in addition to that. Something that's going to, one, sit on your network like the iSensor, block new attacks as they come in through IP-based packets, back that up with something that's going to scan each email in its entirety at the server, and block these types of attacks. The one thing I would recommend those people look for is the speed at which those products and services are updated by the company. Because what often happens is it ends up becoming a race between the attackers and the defenders to see who can get to that target network first. The defenders get their patches and their security signatures in place first, the attack fails. If the attacker gets there first, clearly the attack succeeds.
Well, it sounds like you're not ready to make the step that, or to recommend that enterprises go to the length of declaring all media files forbidden as a matter of network policy? Or is that the way to go for the short term?
If I was a corporate security director at a company, I would advise a committee of that risk, but that is a decision that I would reach in conjunction with a human resources department and a overall corporate risk officer. I think clearly there is risk there that could be reduced by eliminating those files. That would, as always, experience tells you anytime you have that instinct to cut off a technology for security reasons, an experienced security officer is going to immediately ask himself what type of business opportunities would then be cut off. Many sales organizations use video and not so much audio files, but a lot of video real-time conferencing in their sales strategies.
Right.
A lot of people are using WebEx, other types of applications along those lines. What you might find is you announce one day willy-nilly that these video files are banned. You could have a significant backlash from your sales department. and you would want to understand what that reaction would be before you went and made that step, both for the company's well-being as well as your own. Additionally, one thing I will say is I will agree with you that eliminating this technology from the network by a policy would clearly reduce the ability of attackers to break in.
Well, certainly, but I like your statement that you, as with all security, you know, the cost-benefit analysis has to take place.
Some of us learn that early in our careers. Others in security have learned the hard way.
Now, one last thing, and this is probably the topic for an entirely different discussion, but I noticed that in your answer on the enterprise side, you did mention having a security management partner, unless you are a very large enterprise who's able to afford some significant staffing and expertise in security. Are we at the point where all but the very largest organizations need to accept the fact that they can't afford to have sufficient expertise in-house to fully protect their network and IT assets?
All is a strong term. For example, I would say that typically a security company itself would be an exception to that rule, since that's their purpose, and security companies tend to take care of their own corporate networks. Some consulting shops that do security services have the expertise in-house. However, to answer your question, in 98-99% of cases, unless there is an extraordinary technology focus and that technology focus has a security-like bent to it, they could theoretically afford to bring those people on staff, and there may or may not be people on the management team that would have that inclination for different reasons, personal or professional, but I have not yet seen a case for a small or medium-sized company where it made economic sense, where they could get the kind of value out of having that staff on board that they could do it in for as little money as it would take to partner with a security services company, if that makes sense.
Sure. Well, very good. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, sir, for your time.
Well, that was my conversation with Josh Damont, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to look at my iPod quite the same way after this, or for that matter, look at iTunes or Windows Media Player or RealPlayer or any of the other things that I tend to have running on my laptop or desktop at any one time. Interesting to think about how the increased capabilities carry with them increased risk. Be fascinating to think about the possibilities if we can ever break out of that particular cycle. Well, I mentioned lots more podcasts to come in future. We've got things on internal security, on the Oath Initiative, lots of podcasts coming up. And wanted to tell you also about one of the changes for me. I'm becoming the person who's evangelizing podcasting through TechWeb and the CMP Technology Publications. Looking forward to that. I'm going to continue doing this podcast for a number of reasons, not the least of which is I really enjoy doing it. But more important than ever, if you have an idea for a podcast, please drop me a line. cfranklin@cmp.com. Let me know what sorts of podcasts you would like to hear. We'll make sure we get them on. Thanks for listening. Hope that this has been a little less than a half hour well spent for you, and we'll look forward to having you take a listen the next time we have a podcast from the Security Channel of Network Computing. Until then, this is Curtis Franklin saying so long.